This program is brought to you by Fine Diners Over 40, a members-only dinner club for singles and couples who enjoy dining at highly rated restaurants and sharing the experience with others. Learn more at FineDinersOver40.com. That's FineDinersOver40.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hey, Internet Radio, what is good? You are listening to Recommended Reading with Food Book Fair on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Amanda Dell.
And I'm Kimberly Chow. We are the co-hosts of Recommended Reading, where we talk about what we are reading, watching, and listening to with our friends and family around the food world, in and around the food world. We're also the co-directors of Food Book Fair, an annual, now biannual, food media festival in New York City, and coming to you soon in Los Angeles.
Yeah, if you're listening live today, definitely check out foodbookfair.com.
Our brand new, just launched.
It's brand spanking new. And we released our programming for Food Book Fair LA, which is happening March 2nd to the 4th. Most of it will be happening at Ace Hotel. We're also doing a special West Coast Foodiaticals pop-up at Smorgasburg LA. And we're partnering with an amazing new bookstore in Los Angeles called Now Serving.
Yeah, so head to foodbookfair.com. You can also check out at foodbookfair on all of our social media platforms to see more. And that will take us right into a little bit of what we're reading, watching, and listening to, which is what we always talk about at the top of the show. There's a little LA connection there. But maybe we will first tease that we are so excited to have later on joining us the one and only Alexander Smalls, who's a legendary self-described social minister, opera singer, chef, restaurateur, author, including co-author most recently of Between Harlem and Heaven, Afro-Asian American Cooking for Big Nights, Weeknights, and Every Day with J.J. Johnson and Veronica Chambers. Really excited to have him on the show in a little bit. But first, we're going to talk about what we are reading, watching, and listening to.
Yeah, so we'll start with you, Kim.
LA connection.
Yes, what's on your nightstand?
Thank you for following me along on this telegraphic ability to bury the lead that I have. But I've been reading Karina Chicano's You Play the Girl, which is a series of essays that our friend Yadon Israel, who runs Literary Swag Book Club, best book club in the city.
By far.
He suggested this one, and they did a book club meeting about this. And it's about women being asked to play the girl, the damsel in distress, the girlfriend, the wife, in movies in Hollywood, but also how they're asked to play this role in their lives and in society.
Fiction or nonfiction?
It's nonfiction.
Oh, okay.
A book of essays. Karina Chicano is going to be part of another event series that we really love called Tables of Contents with the folks from Egg Restaurant, including Chef Evan Hanser, who's the fearless leader of Tables of Contents. It's a series that we love where they invite living authors to read a little bit, and then Evan pairs a snack with what they're reading, as well as Egg's famous mini biscuits.
Food and books.
We couldn't love anything more or more better.
If we tried.
But they are doing the very first installment of Tables of Contents with Karina and some other amazing authors with Chef Evan in the house and Now Serving, our cookbook partner in LA. We're all tying this together, but all of our favorite people are going to be out there. That's February 15th. You can check out at Egg Restaurant for more details.
Amazing. Thanks for a great recommend.
Yeah. So that's what I'm reading, and I'm reading that while also listening on repeat to the Black Panther soundtrack, which is really good. It's curated by Kendrick Lamar, who I recently found out we have birthdays only 7 days apart. And it's helping me sort of reevaluate my relationship with his music. We're both Geminis. We just both finished our Saturn returns. Black Panther soundtrack's really good.
Do you say welcome back on a Saturn return? Or
it's unclear. It's unclear. I might be okay. Like, I literally still have baggage from my Saturn return. I haven't unpacked yet.
Well, as soon as you're fully unpacked, welcome back.
Yeah. But in the meantime, I'm listening to on repeat specifically the song Redemption, which features Zachary, who's on Kendrick's album Damn, and Babes Wodumo, who is an awesome South African singer.
Cool. Well,
are you reading or listening to?
I've actually more been thinking about something and I want to make a public statement here on our show that want to be committed to helping this initiative and this organization. And it was incredibly inspiring to me to hear about what they are doing. So I'll quickly share that. Mm-hmm. There is an organization called Black Lunch Table. They are described as an oral history archiving project. Mm. I found them mostly through Instagram and loved kind of just looking at what they were doing and, sometimes like earmarking their meetups and just seeing if I was going to be around. And the most interesting thing that they shared on Instagram recently was that they are having a call to action for meetups where Black artists who don't have a Wikipedia page, everyone will come and make their Wikipedia page for the artists together.
That's awesome.
And I just found that idea, just for lack of a better word, very inspirational. As the daughter of two artists, getting credit for their work is something that I know a lot of them struggle with. And then more recently, they posted something very specific, which I really want to try to help with, which was, I don't know if, did everyone see, and by everyone, I mean Kim and maybe Alexander, but I don't want to make you come on the mic before we've formally brought you to the stage, a new stage. The former president and first lady portraits.
President Parisi and Prey.
They were so amazing.
I wish this clapping could be louder. Yeah. David? Can we get the button? No? Okay.
Okay.
So, there we go. Okay. Round of applause for Amy Sherald and Kehinde Wiley.
Yes, exactly. And I just, Blank Lunch Table was just in my Instagram feed again today saying, who is going to add these portraits to these artists' Wikipedia pages? And so I'm just inspired by that. And I definitely want to work on some Wikipedia pages. So
that sounds amazing.
What I've been thinking
Media
about.
Media making.
Yes.
In action.
Exactly.
And with that, maybe we should invite on our special guest for today, Mr. Alexander Smalls, for your take on those new presidential and first lady portraits. And also a question of what you're reading, watching, and listening to. What do you think?
Well, let me first say how nice it is to be here with you.
Welcome.
In Brooklyn, having had a nice slice of pizza at Roberta's before we got started. Yeah.
This is our humble brag, is that it was Alexander's first time coming to Roberta's.
Loved it.
And luckily, we were lucky enough to sneak in a pizza. So thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
A customized Speck and Wolf. Thanks, yes. Roberta's.
Very good. Well, I mean, in terms of the portraits, they are fantastic.
Wow.
Drop dead, gorgeous and expressive and textured, colorful. It signals in many ways a new beginning to an old and overly traditional craft of presidential portraits. I thought it was brilliant and insightful and very much a part of the times.
And surprising. They were revealed, I almost didn't know what to do with myself. I was like, wow.
Well, you know what you get when you call Kehinde Wiley.
Yeah. Yes.
I mean, that wasn't as much a surprise as how beautiful it was when you finally saw it.
Mm-hmm.
But First Lady, wow. I mean, but it framed and captured, her, I felt, brilliantly. I loved it. Loved it.
As you say, there's something so... It contemporizes a practice, a tradition that is very old-fashioned.
Yes.
And in such a fresh and vibrant way.
Yeah.
I think it just looks really cool. I mean, and aesthetically pleasing.
Hopefully a new beginning.
Yeah.
With respect to how we express ourselves. And it's great for contemporary artists because all of a sudden this opens the door to more expressive people in their craft beyond just the portrait realization. But, you know, you can bring texture and life and a bit of flamboyance to the experience.
Indeed.
Yeah. So, Alexander, what's on your nightstand or what are you listening to? What are you cooking? What can you recommend to us as something that we should be doing?
We know that you are busy on the book tour trail,
yes.
But it sounds like as an artist yourself, you've got a lot on your plate in addition that you're enjoying.
Well, I do. I mean, I'm having a really good time. I would have to say that what's mostly been on my nightstand is, you know, bottles of mineral water.
Okay, what's your brand of choice? What's your mineral water brand of choice?
Poland Spring.
Okay.
You know, ever since grad school, which was a long time ago in the 70s, I've been drinking Poland Springs. And, you know, I'm one of those brand loyal people. Mm. you know, but mostly my night table, my bed, everything has been filled with, you know, the work. For the last couple of years, the work of this book, Between Harlem and Heaven, and also a new project that I've started, they really take up the majority of my time. And when I'm not doing that, you know, my great love is HGTV. I mean, you know, I've fallen in love with tiny houses. I've fallen in love with boat houses, with container houses, with do-it-yourself prefab. I just love all of that sort of efficient way of creating a new way to live. You know, and it's what's really funny about this is because, you know, before I grew up in the South, so I grew up in open plains and lots of room and space. And the greatest argument when I moved to New York or problem for me was adapting myself to, you know, my first apartment was probably 350 square feet, you know.
That's my current apartment.
Yeah, it was a one bedroom and to make it feel more spacious, you know, in the middle of the night, I knocked down the wall. But that's another story.
Yeah, well, hey, maybe we'll talk about that.
Studio. But and I'm not DIY at all, but it's just all of a sudden I see this efficient way to manage how we live, and I like it. So, yeah, that's what I've been doing, watching a lot of HGTV.
Is there a specific show that we should be watching and putting on our list?
Well, you know,
more
my favorites, you know.
Sounds like there's more than one.
Well, yeah, of course. And, you know, I love, you know, the one with the couple from Texas, Fix Up. I love that. And I love, again, Tiny House and Exotic Tiny House.
Right.
I like them all.
Do you think you could live in a tiny house?
I'd like to think so.
Okay.
You know, I'm in love with the idea that I could. I might have to have two, you know. I mean, and I've seen people put a couple together with a nice porch, a patio. So, you know, lanai, if you will.
Love it. You know, prefab lanai.
Yeah.
But I think I could get into it. You know, the main thing is that the kitchen obviously would take up most of the space.
Right.
You know, so the whole thing, you know, but they have now the roofs that electronically stretch and go up, and then the sides can go out. You know, so, and then when you're riding, putting it on the trailer to go, you know, all that compacts in. So I would need a loft bedroom where the roof goes up.
Uh-huh.
And then in the living room space, that would need to extend out on both sides because the kitchen really would be the whole thing.
Sounds like you've put some thought into this.
I've designed this thing. I'm ready to go. I just need a backer.
If there are any backers out there that would like to make this prefab lanai fantasy happen, please hit us up. We'll pass along the message. But we will also start talking about Between Harlem and Heaven, the philosophy behind Afro-Asian American cooking with Alexander Smalls just after this break. We'll be right back.
Come for the food, stay for the friends. Fine Diners Over 40 is a members-only dinner club for singles and couples who enjoy dining at highly rated restaurants and sharing the experience with others. Fine Diners Over 40 appreciate food as art, as cultural adventure, as scientific experiment, and best of all, food as an opportunity to take pleasure in the company of others. Join them for culinary and social adventures in New York and Seattle. Food may be the main attraction at Fine Diners Over 40 events, but it is the friendly and interesting members who carry the day. Join them for an evening of fine dining, fun, and stimulating conversation. While enjoying innovative tasting menus by first-rate chefs, you'll talk movies, theater, pets, sports, travel, and more. Epicurus said it best. We should look for someone to eat and drink with before looking for something to eat and drink. Learn more at finediners40.com. That's finediners40.com.
Loving this commercial music this time around. Hey guys.
Welcome back.
Recommended reading with Food Book Fair.
We are thrilled to be, if you're just tuning in, we're thrilled to be joined in the studio by Alexander Smalls. He is the co-author of a brand new book, Between Harlem and Heaven. So first, congratulations on the book.
Thank you.
We know how much time and energy and work that takes.
Yes.
Very excited. You know, you can work on something for so long, and then when you finally see it out in the world, it's pretty exciting.
Pretty exciting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So maybe we can start by taking it back a little bit and talking about where you're from, which is South Carolina, mm-hmm. and your journey becoming a opera singer and how that afforded you the opportunity to travel all over the world and Europe, and then coming back to the States and eventually becoming a restaurateur.
Wow,
so maybe let's start in the beginning a little bit and with your childhood in South Carolina, and were you always interested in food? How did you become involved in music?
Well, you know, I was very fortunate to be born into a very busy, busy family, an extended family.
Okay.
My parents, my mother had a very pleasant voice that you could hear now and then when she was doing housework or... she was a dressmaker, so sometimes when she was making dresses, you know, she would sing softly and sweetly, but very shy voice. Her voice had nothing to do with who she was, because she was a force to be reckoned with. But when she sang, it was the sweetest thing. And then my father had a beautiful tenor voice, and he sang in the church choir. So music was always present. My uncle, who was a chef, lived in New York, and married to Aunt Laura, who was a classical pianist. When I was born, they had no children, and I was the first male child. I have a sea of girls, sisters, and cousins. So it was just, I was the first male. My uncle and aunt, in a matter of 2 or 3 years, moved from New York back to South Carolina to be a part of my coming of age and growing up. They wanted to really bring their influences, really, on my life. And so I had this incredible wealth of culture and classics in the two of them. And the way our neighborhood was, my parents lived on one end of the triangle, my father the other in the center, and then my uncle. There was the family garden, because my grandfather was a city farmer, and his backyard was about a third of an acre, and a half of an acre or more, and the garden was about a third. And that garden I had to walk through every day to get to either one of my grandfather's house or my uncle's. But my aunt and uncle were really the kind of saints and leaders of my cultural education. She was my piano teacher, and he was the person in my life who made cooking magical and expressive. I mean, if I could say anything about my uncle, he gave me permission to be fanciful, creative, and lose my mind while enjoying cooking. Mm. And so I started that at an early age. But at the very foundation of all of that was my grandfather, who was a city farmer, and would grow from seed a majority of the food that we would eat, during the summer and much of the fall. Mm. He also would lease land in the countryside and raise farm animals. Mm. So at a very early age, I understood where food came from, how it got here, how it took care of us, if we took care of it. Some of the most extraordinary moments of my life is in that garden with my grandfather. Wasn't a very religious man wasn't a churchgoer, but I always felt the nourishment, the spirituality in that garden. And he would tell me stories about my family and his parents essentially where I came from. We would spend a lot of time, I grew up in Spartanburg, South Carolina, but we would spend summers and a lot of time making trips to the Low Country, which was Charleston, Beaufort, and the Gullah Islands, where the character of that side of my family was shaped, and who we were and who I grew up to be came out of that experience. Because we also were the only people that I knew in my community that ate Low Country food. Everybody else ate different food, just regular Southern food. But we had Low Country cooking in my home, which essentially is regional cooking from the Low Country. And very different. I'm eating grits with smothered crab meat gravy over with shrimp, and my friends had never heard of it. You know, so stews and fishes and you know, crab soup and all these things that nobody in Spartanburg were eating. Mm-hmm. So food was everything. It was the centerpiece of our lives. And essentially, that's where my respect and sense of importance for food came from. And as a young man, I understood and learned that food was currency and power. And the person who cooked will most of the human currency. And I wanted to be that person. But at the same time, I was being shaped to be this classical musician, listening to Renata Scotto, listening to Renata Tebaldi, Caruso, all of these singers at a very early age, and playing piano. And that really set the foundation.
Wow.
That's a lot, I know.
Clearly that food and music and deriving joy and pleasure out of these sensory experiences clearly were always together, foundational
always
in your life.
And continue to be. Mm. Which is no surprise that when I hit a glass ceiling in the classical world, as an opera singer, I'd gone as far as I could go in the United States in terms of what I could do as an African-American male singer in this classical discipline. Mm. And like most of my counterparts, they went to Europe, mostly German houses. Mm-hmm. And the only part about that was they would come home sung out, you know, because they would work like workhorses in these opera houses, singing over and over several times a day, and they'd come back and the voices would be shot. I didn't want that experience for myself. Now, I did travel extensively as a singer throughout Europe. I spent 2.5-3 years living in Rome and Florence, studying with Maestro Gobbi, Tito Gobbi, who was the great Scarpia with Maria Callas. Mm. And I would take lessons at his house. And in the summer, he taught at this villa in Fiesole. And I would go there and I'd work with Maestro. And, you know, it was an extraordinary experience, but my career wasn't going where I needed it to go. And from that experience, I realized that I needed to own my own stage. Mm. I couldn't own an opera house, but I could own a restaurant. And that was my equal love that I had shared throughout this experience of becoming a musician. So I took my living room public and opened my first restaurant in the early 90s because somebody else had to pay for dinner. And I was spending all my money having these parties in my house.
And when and where was that first restaurant?
Yeah,
Cafe Beulah on 19th and Park Avenue South. that was the, this is how it all started.
This is how it began.
Yeah.
And how different was it to open a restaurant at that time compared to, let's say, opening a restaurant in 2018? And was that neighborhood desirable in the same way that it was now? What were some of the challenges and what were some of the best things that happened when opening that restaurant?
I would say the biggest challenge was opening a restaurant, period. Right. Having not, I was an artist. I never owned a business. I'd never run a business. I'd never, with the exception of having a small catering concern, I'd never run a professional kitchen. Mm. I was so completely out of my comfort zone or what I had prepared for, but I was determined, and I didn't have enough sense to believe that I couldn't do it. So I did it. I sold the idea on everybody, but you know, everybody said, this is great, oh, I'd love to be a partner, blah, 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 blah. But, you know, it would just be a conversation at another party I gave because I didn't know how to turn my excitement, my desire, into a working plan. Mm. Finally, a friend suggested, you know, you need a business plan. You know, I mean, you know, everybody gets all excited. You talk about it. We want to be there tomorrow. But beware. Invest in what? You need a business plan. And I was like, well, what the hell is a business plan?
That's a good
plan?
Friend, right?
Yeah. Well, it was the best friend. Because then, all of a sudden now, a business plan stood in the way of me taking my living room public and opening a restaurant. I was like, well, okay, I got to figure out what that is. So he suggested a book. And he was also in the business. And he suggested a book that I went to Columbia University and bought. They were teaching in the business school there on writing business proposals and how they work. Now, the hardest book with reference to that I had read was one on theory and arpeggio and musical, fundamentals, you know, which can be daunting, which is why a lot of doctors end up being pianists or playing violin in the little theater because, you know, it's almost science as opposed to creative arts. But I mastered that concept of how to write a business plan because I was so determined to take this dream to a place of reality. So I wrote a business plan. And, you know, I sent it around to friends and who basically gave me suggestions. But essentially, I had a business plan. So then I started that journey of trying to get people to invest. And then somebody said, okay, well, you've got all these people who want to invest, but you don't. What are they investing in? Mm-hmm. You need a subscription agreement. Well, what the hell is a subscription agreement? This is how you form a relationship with investors. What they put in, what they get for what they're putting in, and then you put in a clause for a divorce or exit strategy, and all these things, and that makes it real. So we had to learn how to do that. Luckily, I had a friend who was an attorney, got all that together, and then called all of my great friends. And I was very lucky to have friends like Felicia Rashad, the writer Toni Morrison, Percy Sutton, who owned at one point the Apollo and WBLS, and Artie Pacheco from Canton Fitzgerald, a whole bunch of people who like threw the first bucks on the table and said, we're going to help you do this.
Wow.
And that's how the first restaurant was born.
An amazing community.
I was very fortunate.
What was it like opening those doors the first night?
Oh my gosh. Okay, so what I have to tell you is, you know, my business proposal was a good one, but, you know, I ran out of money, needless to say. Mm. I mean, I took over an existing restaurant that I had to refurbish and, you know, trying to watch the budget and all this stuff, I ran out of money. So we essentially, we were 5 days from opening and I didn't have the money to buy groceries to stock the restaurant. I mean, this is how bad it got.
Better go down to your dad's and get his stuff from his pantry.
Well,
right?
You know what I did? I called up my very good friend, the opera singer Kathleen Battle, and I said, Kathleen, you know this has been a dream of mine forever. I need to borrow some money to buy groceries. She didn't hesitate. And Kathleen is not a frivolous woman, so, you know, she wouldn't just write a check because I showed up in my best, you know, starched shirt and or my down-and-out trotters. No, she came to my rescue. She loaned me the money to stock the kitchen. And, look, we had no option but to be the biggest success from day one. And that happened. That happened. We opened it and they came. That's amazing. It was really a miracle. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you had Cafe Beulah, and then you opened its sister restaurant, Sweet Ophelia.
I did. You opened
another one in Grand Central Terminal. And then you took a break for
Well, right after 9/11, that devastated me because we had just opened the restaurant in Grand Central Station. And, you know, things were rolling out, doing well. Mm-hmm. And then 9/11. Mm-hmm. And, of course, Grand Central was rumored to be one of the targets. And after that period, there were a lot of scares of terrorism. And we must have evacuated 10 times prior to that whole thing. Mm-hmm. People were staying away. People didn't want to be in those kind of spaces or underground. And we had just opened. So, you know, we strangled and choked. And I was really forced out of business. Mm-hmm. So there had to be a period of healing. I did know that period would take 10 years, but I essentially had to, I closed it. I moved to Harlem, where I now reside. And I took a vacation from the restaurant industry, but not the food industry. And I built up my catering company in that period. But I also started out on my journey to develop what I now call Afro-Asian-American cooking, which is what we talk about in this book.
Yeah. So why don't we talk a little
bit? You make our job so easy for us, Alexander.
Interviewer. So you took a little break.
Yeah.
But as with your break from, or transition from opera to running restaurants, it was a break that led to different adventures that have led to where you are now.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So expand upon what that term means to you. Afro-Asian cooking, and how you implemented that in your restaurants, the Cecil and Minton's. And also, this is a little bit of an add-on question, which maybe we can get to, but I was reading about how you found your chef, J.J. Johnson, and I thought that was a really interesting story.
Yes.
So, and also, you were looking for someone that could, you know, embody this idea of Afro-Asian cooking, and also someone that could pull it off and work together with you.
That's right. So, where do I start?
Yeah, start with Afro-Asian cooking.
Start with Afro-Asian cooking and how it all began.
Afro-Asian cooking. Okay, so, you know.
Or how it began for you.
Yes.
Well, you know, there are a number of people in the field that inspire me, truly, truly inspire me. And with that inspiration, I felt very strongly after 10 years out of the business of restaurants that I needed to expand upon the narrative of the African-American and African diaspora culinary legacy as it relates to its effect and its impression on global cooking. You know, there hasn't been enough done in the field to really legitimize and elevate, celebrate, and really talk about those extraordinary contributions that Africa, the African diaspora, has really made to the world of food. African Americans, Africans all over the world are still being really forced into a narrow discipline about cooking. Mm. It's French, it's European, and really in order to be recognized in this profession, that has to be first and foremost. The problem is that when you look at it as a skill, it may very well make sense to some, but it's not organic or authentic to people of color.
Mm.
And to essentially continue the myth that African-Americans, Africans in general, only contribution to culinary is soul food is ludicrous for so many reasons. And the term soul food really comes out of a marketing and promotion concept of the 60s, 70s, the Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud, really kind of galvanizing a source of pride. But if you think about the role of African-Americans and African people in culinary in our history, particularly on the five continents, they have been the agricultural foundation. And they've been the culinary foundation because they were only people cooking for the most part everywhere they traveled. as slaves, that was what they were essentially made to do. So, you know, you have African slaves that go back to China, the 1500s, and the largest population of Africans, thanks to the Portuguese, outside of Africa, is in Brazil. Those influences in all of our cultural expression, culinary, have been there in the root of African cooking. And then you have the Asian cross-section. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's really quite extraordinary because also the Asian Indians and the Chinese really came in when the slaves were freed and did the work that they did as migrant workers and lived with Africans and the African slaves in those various communities. And they, in turn, created a culinary and cultural expression. So my job, as I defined it for myself, is that I followed the tracks of forced migration of slavery of African people. And in the various countries and places that they ended up, what their contributions were, what was the food of that particular location. And the idea was to essentially create a discipline that mirrored those contributions and really created a culinary language to talk about. So I came up with this idea of Afro-Asian American cooking because it kind of took in the landscape of the five continents that were most affected by slavery. And once I'd done all of that, then it was like, okay, now I need to make this real. Mm-hmm. I needed to put it in practice. So as I've always done in the five restaurants that I've had, I intentionally and with vengeance look for other African-Americans, Africans in the profession of hospitality, chefs, managers, to essentially bring into this what I think is an organic expression. And also because the way and the events of our society when there was a time when African Americans were the only people you saw in kitchens. And now you go to most kitchens, they look like a Ralph Lauren showroom. You know, I mean, James Beard went to Europe and came back and gave everybody permission, including and mostly white men, permission to cook, permission to call themselves chef. There was money, there was celebrity, and all of a sudden the rules were changed. Mm-hmm. A lot of the rules basically meant that the African Americans who were doing that before no longer qualified because they didn't have their certificate from this academy or that. It's just like, you know, all the rules were changed and it kind of changed overnight. And many African-Americans were forced out of a career and a discipline that had been their entire life. In my family, there were at least, you know, two aunts that were chefs, cooks, four uncles. You know, it just went on and on. So basically, I set out to find a team that could really help me move the conversation into action. So I was interviewing a whole lot of people, and I was on the internet going through resume, profile, and I came across this clip from Rocco's dinner party.
That's where it was from. Yes. Okay.
And there was this young man who captured my attention for a couple of reasons. A, he reminded me of my father and the way he looked. Mm. And two, he made and won the competition cooking the only meal my father cooked in our house, and usually on Sundays or special holidays, which was smothered shrimp and crab meat gravy over grits.
Wow.
So he made smothered shrimp. And I was like, is the universe telling me something? So, you know, I liked everything I saw. I especially liked his attitude. He was like a thoroughbred. He knew he was going to win. He just was like this. I mean, really knew this was his to take. Mm-hmm. And I tracked him down. It turns out he didn't live that far from me. So I invited him for breakfast. And he came in, and he you know, in the meantime, I told him, as he says, I sent him a long letter, but as you can see, I'm very verbal in my expression. So He said he came. He didn't know who I was. He thought maybe I was a little crazy. I was talking about Afro-Asian American cookie. He'd never heard of it. I was talking about opening two restaurants in Harlem at a time when it still didn't make sense because Harlem wasn't that developed yet. And these were multi-million dollar projects, you know. And I was a black person, which basically there are not that many black restaurateurs that essentially can forge that conversation in the landscape.
Yeah.
So we sat down and I watched his skepticism and I just went into my spiel and I was telling him and I said, you know, I think you have what it takes to join me on this. And at the very end, I could see he was kind of warming up at least. It's sort of like that person inside him was allowing him to say, well, maybe this guy's got something. And this is how it all started.
Do you remember what you made for breakfast?
That was my question. Oh.
Well, but I didn't cook breakfast.
Oh, you did. Okay.
You know, I've been asked that question. I didn't make breakfast. Well, okay. I thought that would be too much.
Okay.
I mean, meeting someone for the first time inviting them to my house to have, I thought we had to take steps. So
very smart.
Like a first date.
Yeah, this is a first date. We'll meet in a public place. We'll sit near the door. You
where
can
did
run.
You, where did you go? Clearly, he didn't have to make it through the door.
Well, what happened is that the conversation went well enough that I said, look, I'm having a dinner party, just so happens, at the end of the week. You should join. Bring your girlfriend. Come. There'll be a lot of interesting people there. Mm-hmm. And you know, you'll see the kind of food that I do and where I'm taking this, you know, this culinary conversation. So he came. And
second date.
Yeah,
not
second
bad.
Date. I think it was a little overwhelming. The room, you know, my parties tend to be eclectic. And so, you know, there could be anybody from a captain of industry to the pizza boy, you know, a famous actress or musician. And actually, all of that was there. Some he recognized and some he found out the hard way. You know, when you ask a famous diva, what do you do for a living?
Ooh.
You know, there's almost no recovery. Don't you know who I am? But he came and he worked himself into the fabric of my friends.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we would have conversations about the food I created and blah, blah, blah. And then the next day he would come over and we would, you know, have these great talks. And he started to get into it. And all of a sudden, things started to happen. So, I was invited as a celebrity chef to Ghana, Accra, to do an American Thanksgiving.
Mm-hmm.
And I said to him, would you like to go with me? This will be your audition. And he did, and here we are.
What a big question.
You know?
I'm glad it worked out. We're both glad it worked out.
Yeah.
We're all glad.
Yes.
And we have Between Harlem and Heaven, thank goodness. That's our child.
Also, both Amanda and I recently read Michael Twitty's book.
Good friend.
And he spoke at Food Book Fair 2017, where J.J. Johnson appears at the end of the book, where he talks about that experience going to Ghana for the first time and the idea of Afro-Asian cooking sinking into his mind and understanding and being able to see that through line connecting from West Africa to the American South and the Great Migration, et cetera. Which is pretty powerful.
Pretty powerful.
It's incredible to see the work that y'all have done, the work that you continue to do with this philosophy, with the new cookbook, as well as with the restaurants in real life. Congratulations again. Is there anything, we're running out of time,
but
time
honestly,
clock, but we could
I
be here
really felt like we could be here until next week's show.
I'll come back.
Share
two-part show. More pizza.
Yes. I feel like there's so much we discussed, but also so much we could tap into.
Yeah.
So really, really highly recommend this book because if you loved, which I imagine that you did hearing what Alexander had to say, you get even more insight to that and other stories and inspiration in the book, Between Harlem and Heaven. And it's available wherever fine books are sold, whether you choose to support your local bookstore, which we're always a fan of, or go onto the internet and get it. Definitely recommend that you pick it up. And I think the recipes when I looked at them, felt very approachable, but also challenging in the sense that I didn't feel as if I had cooked a lot of these dishes or anything like them before. So I'm very excited to dive in.
As a little bit of a teaser for our listeners before we have to get off the air, are there any recipes or stories within? And it's a lot of storytelling mixed with recipes in here that you have top of mind or are particularly excited about to be sharing.
Well, you know,
we hear you're a big fan of hot dogs.
Yes.
And a version of your famous hot dog recipe is
there,
in this book.
Right. Had to be. It was in the restaurant too. And people are like, what is that doing here? Have one.
They're like, don't you know this is my place?
You know, what I would say about the book is that we, you know, most of these recipes and the flavor profile we created were created in my apartment. So it started at home and then went to the commercial kitchen. Mm. So we created a book of recipes that you can do at home. And the variety is pretty unique because we have a little something for everybody. You know, strong on vegetables, and the book is strong on the mix of flavors. I would say to get a simple, quick understanding and flavor profile, I would do the collard green salad.
Okay.
I would make the collard green salad maybe the first thing you do just to kind of feel what the Afro-Asian American experience is trying to say to you. Mm. And then go from there.
We'll do it.
That sounds delicious.
And we'll report back to you.
Collard greens and hot dogs and beyond. There's so much in this book, and it's also incredibly beautiful. It's called Between Harlem and Heaven, Afro-Asian American Cooking for Big Nights, Weeknights. And every day we're here with one of its authors, Alexander Smalls. It's been such a delight having you. Thank you.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah.
We'll see you around.
Yes, please.
More pizza soon. And internet listeners, we'll be back on soon, too. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Recommended reading is powered by Simplecast. Simplecast is a popular hosting and analytics platform that allows podcasters to easily host and publish to apps like Apple Podcasts. If you have a podcast or are looking to create your very first, check it out. Try it for free and save half off your first 3 months at simplecast.com/heritage.